Hello and welcome to the call. I'd appreciate it if everyone that's on the call would kindly hit the star six button on your phones so we can mute all background noises. That's everyone, of course, except our guest. And at the end of the call, we'll ask a few questions. And at that time, if you would like to ask a question, you can push the star six so we can hear you. Okay, the format for the call is simply that I will interview our guest, Sue Silverman. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Dotsie Bregel, and I'm founder of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, which can be found at nabbw.com, and boomerwomenspeak.com, which are the number one sites on major search engines for baby boomer women. Since launching boomerwomenspeak.com, it's almost 7 years ago, I've been connecting, encouraging, and supporting boomer women on a daily basis. I dedicate a great portion of my time to creating opportunities that inspire women to explore their passions and live them to the fullest. If you're on the call and you're not a member of the NABBW, feel free to email me at dots@nabbw.com, and I'll be happy to send you a link to join for $25 off the fee of $75. And this teleseminar is one of the many benefits of being a member of the NABBW, and you can see them all posted at nabbw.com. And this is one of probably, I think, 65 teleseminars that are archived on the members-only page. And you can listen to them while you're working online, and we also have them all transcribed so you can print them if you like and read them at your convenience. Okay. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce today's guest, Sue Williams Silverman. Sue, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm glad I didn't lose you.
Right.
Sue Silverman's new book is Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir. And I have to say, I'm a big fan of Sue's since we met back in 2002 when I launched Boomer Women Speak. She submitted a story, and we've been corresponding ever since. Her memoir, which is Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, which was published by Norton, is also a Lifetime TV movie. And her first memoir, Because I Remember Terror Father, I Remember You, won the AWP Award in Creative Nonfiction, and that's the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Award. And I want to share that I've read all of your books, Sue.
Oh,
and
thank
I'm just a huge fan.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet.
Yes. And in fact, after reading your memoir book was when we decided to do the writing contest together for the association, and we had many really good submissions.
I mean, I know.
It was really hard.
It was terrific. I was incredibly impressed.
Yeah, so that was a fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Sue teaches at the Low Residency MFA in Writing Program at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she's appeared on The View and Anderson Cooper 360. For more information, you can even contact her through her website if you want to email her with anything after the call. At SueWilliamSilverman.com. Okay, Sue, how are you today?
I'm good, and I just want to thank you so much for inviting me to do this teleseminar, and a big thanks to all the listeners there who have called in. And I just really love what you're doing with the Boomer Women's website.
So thanks.
It's a real thrill to be here today.
Well, good. Yes, we should have a good time because these are always good because the women who call in are intentionally listening because it's something that they're interested in. So
right.
Let's start by giving them some good information. So one of the things that you talk about is the redemptive power of memoir. And of course, we just want to mention, and I'm sure you will, that writing memoir is very different than writing anything else. And we'll get into some of that. But tell us about the redemptive power of writing memoir.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there really is a sense that by writing your own story, your life story, that it is a kind of redemptive journey. I mean, I guess I think of it in terms of discovering your emotional truth, sort of the kernel. You know, we all have our own truths and our own kind of life force, if you will. And I think that that is a part of being of kind of redemption, is sort of discovering your emotional truth, which kind of frees up this life force. You know, there's only one of you, and your voice is unique. And if you don't express yourself, you don't really fully discover who you are, and that essence of you will be lost. So by writing your memoir, I think it is kind of redemptive in terms of finding that emotional truth and that life force. And I think another way that it's redemptive is also by writing our stories, we really are helping others to heal. And I think there's an enormous amount of redemption around that. I mean, I just get so many emails from women who basically, you know, thank me for telling my story, but more importantly, sort of thanking me for telling their story, too. And so that's sort of how I see the idea of redemption in memoir.
Okay, good. And you mentioned how our stories heal others, mm-hmm. and actually so many times often first they heal us. And
yes.
I have not written a memoir, but I do journal, and I have to say that it is through journaling that I've gotten to know myself best. And it's something that was surprising to me because I didn't really understand the power of writing before I journaled.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah. I mean, it's not just that if you want to be a professional writer, you can go out and try and get your work published. But that's only one piece of it. Just writing as a journal or a diary or just kind of, you know, letters or whatever. I mean, just the act of writing really is incredibly empowering. I agree. I mean, I hardly know what I think unless I write. So, yeah.
That's right. Well, I think people with busy minds have that problem because you have a hard time carrying thoughts to fruition. But when you're writing... Mm-hmm. You have no choice but to do so, and that's
right.
Why I think it's so powerful.
Yeah, it's just really going deeper and deeper and deeper into an experience. And, you know, when we're living an experience, you don't really know what it means. You're just sort of thrust in different, you know, daily events, and you go through it. But it's really only through the writing process later that I can come to understand what any given event means.
That's so true. Okay, let's talk about how we should or how we can find courage to write our stories, because a lot of the stories that our generation, and I give a lot of credit to our generation, Sue, and I think you do too,
mm-hmm.
As being the generation of women who really started sharing our voices.
Exactly.
And some of the stories that our women of generation have to tell, and just women, period, aren't stories that they're proud of in the sense that, you know, oh, people are going to hear this and you know, it's going to be great. You need a lot of courage to write those stories. So tell us how to find that courage.
Right. I mean, that's exactly right in that, you know, we're not necessarily writing stories that always put us in a good light.
Mm-hmm.
But we're telling stories that put us in a truthful light. And that's what, you know, is obviously much more important. And in terms of finding the courage, I mean, I think it's a matter of, well, several things. First of all, knowing the most important thing is to get your story down on paper. And I would always suggest do that before you start worrying about, you know, kind of like what will my mother think or what will the neighbors say or, you know, what will just, you know, the general media or anything. That's just taking on way too much putting too much pressure on yourself. So first of all, I would just try to think about writing as just writing for yourself. And that's kind of step one. And then once all of your words are down on paper, you can, you know, kind of worry about the world. But I think in another way to look at it is knowing that we do own our stories. And, you know, things that happen to us, you know, we're the only ones who can tell that story, and just sort of claiming that and knowing that it's our story, and as writers, you know, we're really free to tell them. I know that ultimately I sort of came to that realization, which helped me have a lot of courage. The other thing is to be, you know, in a really good community, not necessarily of other writers, although that can help, but just say in an organization like, you know, Baby Boomers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just an organization where you do have a lot of support, particularly probably other women, who really can sort of hear your voice. And so, you know, if you start off just by saying, well, I have a story, but I'm scared to write it, and then you have get a lot of feedback from other women who say, oh, but, you know, your story really is important. I just think that can really help us find a lot of courage and to not sort of feel alone with all of that. But, you know, with me, you know, I started out as a fiction writer. It was really my therapist who encouraged me to tell my own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really found a lot of courage through his belief in me, kind of before I had my own belief in me. And, you know, that's sort of okay, you know, I mean, to sort of borrow somebody else's courage for you until you kind of find your own. So, I mean, if you have a friend out there or a spouse, you know, a woman friend or, you know, any kind of a support group, and just start sort of talking about, you know, what you would like to do, I think you'd be amazed and very pleased with all the support that you will find about, you know, having the courage to tell your story.
And, you know, I think oftentimes when we just speak it, like our story or a part of our story, mm-hmm. to one other person, it empowers us
to
continue and to carry on.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think that that's true. And also, you know, there is a chapter in Fearless Confession sort of about this whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of kind of quotes and interviews from other memoirists who have sort of gone through the same process and, you know, scared, you know, about what their mothers would think and stuff like that. And so just, you know, kind of listening and reading about what other memoirists have gone through, I think can be helpful to kind of know that, okay, you know, I wrote this book, I put it out there, and kind of the world kept turning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, sure, some of the feedback we get maybe is not going to be what you want to hear, but that doesn't take away from the fact that what you've done is so, so important. And kind of in a bottom-line way, you're going to help a lot more people, including yourself, than you're going to get people, say, angry at you. You know,
right.
It's just there are going to be so many more people who are going to be supporting you and really hearing your voice and being very encouraging to you rather than the opposite.
Yeah, and I remember reading in your book, and it was probably in that chapter, where you talked about you should just pretend that you're writing for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really do. If I start worrying about, you know, well, even if I start worrying about, well, will it ever get published? I mean, that's just, you know, I just try not to think about any of that, what other people will say, what my friends might think, what family might think, whether, you know, just like the people in the media. If you're sitting there in front of your computer with all of that weighing on you, it's too much. It really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's too much. And then I also remember you saying, or someone said, maybe you quoted someone
mm-hmm.
else, that it was about fear being the killer of
good literature.
Yes,
I wish I could take that quote as mine. It's not.
Okay.
James McBride, who wrote The Color of Water, he gave a talk and a reading at Vermont College where I teach, and he said that to this whole, you know, like about, I don't know, over 100 writers, that fear is the killer of good literature. And honestly, everybody in the audience, you could hear them scratching that line down on their pads of paper.
Right.
It just resonated. And, of course, that's with, you know, there are fiction writers and poets in the audience, too. But, I mean, like, everybody wrote that down because, you know, it's true whether you're writing poetry or fiction or nonfiction, it's still scary to put your creative self out there.
Right. Okay. All right. So now once somebody has some courage, and even if,
uh-huh.
you know, I mean, it reminds me in a way of when we were kids and we would write in our diaries and hide them and lock them and everything else because we didn't want anybody else to read our
mm-hmm.
words. And I'm sure that's what people go through when they write, you know, when they write a memoir. And
mm-hmm.
and if that's what you have to do to get started, and if that's what helps you, then, you know, just have the courage to do that. But can you talk about some tips on bringing our stories to life?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things that I try to focus on when I start a new piece really is sensory language. And that sounds so sort of obvious. You know, we always hear about the five senses and using them. But it's absolutely crucial to implement them in order to bring the reader inside your story. And I have just like a little example here that, okay, that so I wrote this memoir, you know, about recovering from sex addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So if I just sort of sat here and either told you or even wrote it this way about, oh, I struggled with sex addiction and, you know, I went into rehab for 28 days and it was really hard. I mean, you can just hear how abstract that kind of
mm-hmm.
language is
mm-hmm.
and that you just ultimately would kind of sound like Time Magazine or something like that. And, I mean, of course, the writing in Time is fine, but it's not, you know, creative. But by using sensory description, I'm just going to read one sentence from Lovesick that sort of would show the difference between, you know, saying, yeah, I really struggled with sex addiction, that was awful. And then here's a sentence about where I'm about to meet, where I've met a dangerous man in a seedy motel, and this is just a one sentence. Mm-hmm. I feel a damp chill between my shoulder blades. How can love be two bodies wrapped in a sheet that's singed with careless cigarettes, here in a room with plastic curtains, tin ashtrays, stained carpet, and artificial air? So just by using that kind of sensory language, you're just bringing the reader right into that motel room, and they can actually, like, enter the experience in that way. And, you know, or just, this is not a sentence from my book, but just let me give you two other sentences just to sort of contrast that. Rather than say, you know, I was in love with a cute guy, you could write, John's hands, the color of cinnamon, stroke my bare shoulders. I mean, just to see the difference between that kind of abstract, flat language, like I was in love with a cute guy, doesn't bring you into that experience. But to actually add that those sensory details, then the reader can kind of feel what it is that you're feeling. So to me, you know, when I start writing anything, a new essay, or when I start writing the two books, that's what I first sort of try to come up with is, you know, I'm sort of picking a moment of when I'm going to start the memoir, and what did that moment smell like? What did it taste like? What did it sound like? What did it feel like? You know, what did it look like? Just really focusing on that, on those sensory details, I think is the best way to write, you know, to have really dynamic writing.
Okay. So you really focus on the senses. Any mm-hmm. other tips for bringing a story to life?
Well, of course, you know, the overall key is to kind of, when you're writing a memoir, even an essay, is to know that even if you're writing, say, a 300-page memoir, that you're not writing a whole life. A memoir is kind of a slice of a life. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to find the theme of any given piece that would very narrowly define what it is you're going to write about. And a theme is not necessarily anything that, like a statement that would actually end up in the book or the essay, but it's something that is important for you, the writer, to know so you can have a really clear focus. And that's why, I mean, even though on the face of it, my two memoirs seem very related, because obviously I had the sex addiction because my father had molested me, so there is that kind of clear connection. But yet, those two books could never have been one. I mean, in the first, I really have to focus on kind of growing up in this incestuous family. I mean, that's the clear focus. The second memoir, Lovesick, that's very narrowly focused on these 28 days I spent in rehab recovering from a sex addiction. And but that's really good news, because, you know, if you could just throw everything into one book, then you only have one book, whereas if you narrowly define it, you get more books to write. And now, I mean, I'm working on an essay collection. I have something like 23 essays. And so, you know, there's a lot of material, and each essay, just like each memoir, has a very, you know, kind of clear and narrowly defined focus. So I think that knowing your theme, that really narrow focus, and then once you know that, you know, trying to bring that theme to life, you know, injecting life into that theme, those are probably the first two things that I think are really important.
Okay, well, let's talk about beginning a story, because like you said, you know, somebody wants to write about something that happened in their childhood, mm-hmm. but your childhood is a very long time,
right?
And it happens over many years, and you know, but how do you narrow it down, and how do you figure out where to start?
Usually the best way not to start is at the beginning. You know, kind of like, well, I was born and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, gosh.
I know. That's like going to, I mean, you're going to be, you yourself as a writer would be asleep by page three. It's usually the best way to start is kind of at the point of impact. What just happened in your life, you know, in terms of the life of the memoir, that causes the action to start? You know, what sort of jump starts the piece? You know, for example, and I know since some of you probably have read my books, you know, Terror Father begins when I first start therapy. And that's when I first, you know, realize I'm ready to kind of deal with my past. So a logical place, so rather than start, Yeah, I mean, I could have started just with the scene of my father molesting me. But that, in a way, didn't seem as if it would give enough of a focus to the book. Because the book, as much as it overall is also, while it's writing about growing up in an incestuous family, the reader also had to know there's kind of help and hope out there. And so in order for the reader to stay with you for the 300 pages or whatever, I think it was also important to for the reader to know that, okay, Sue finally gets help, you know, and so
right.
there she is in therapy. But it also was kind of the point of impact because I would, within the life of the book or within the framework of the book, I did not know how to speak about my childhood until I entered therapy. So that is sort of what jump starts the exploration of the past. And then with Lovesick, it basically begins just right the day before I'm entering rehab. I mean, that's sort of an easier structure because I've got the 28 days that I'm going to be writing about. But I chose to start it not as I'm entering rehab, but really the day before in order to show sort of the contrast and sort of what I'm up against. Like, this is my life outside of, you know, of therapy, which is just a total disaster, and I'm a wreck. And so by starting there and then, bam, you know, write the second chapters, I'm there entering therapy. So, but it's really finding that moment that does kind of jumpstart that action. And usually that's sort of in the middle of things, but then, of course, you know, you'll have flashbacks in either the essay or the book, too, that will show any, you know, your past, whatever it is that led you up to this moment, this kind of point of impact. So it's not that material will be left out. It's just where do you start it? And you want to start it at a moment of really high drama.
Right, and that's what, like you were saying, that book is about the 28 days of rehab. Mm-hmm. But looking back on it, I don't really remember it that way.
That's interesting.
Specifically, you know,
yeah.
Because you intertwined everything that kind of brought you to that moment, too.
Well, exactly. I mean, I start the day before I enter rehab,
right.
But then there's several kind of extended flashbacks that mm-hmm. show that kind of bad behavior of mine before I ever entered rehab. So basically, like, those flashbacks are written with, you know, I'm in rehab, I'm on that unit, and the flashbacks are take the reader kind of into the past to show how it is that I ended up in rehab. So it is a kind of twining between the past and the present.
Yeah, and so what we're going to do at the end is we're going to let anyone on the call ask questions, and that might be a really good question for someone who has a story and can give, like, a little background and say, you know, what might be a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. All right. And because memoirs are so inclusive, mm-hmm. I imagine it would be really hard to decide what to put in and what not to put in. I can tell you, I read lots of memoirs,
mm-hmm.
And I have read some poor ones, and I had to uh-huh. laugh when you said, you know, I was born on, because
right.
I have read one similar to that in particular.
Oh,
and everything is included, and everything is included at length.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't appeal to me at all. So I think that there has to be a way to figure out really what's important to the story. How do you know what to include in your memoir?
Right.
And
well,
I mean, it sounds like a ridiculous question, but
you're absolutely
sort it out.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of beginning writers, and I mean, that is something that I think that, myself included, you know, even now, I mean, it's not that you ever totally figure it out,
right.
Because with these essays I'm writing, I mean, each one sort of has its own challenge. And a lot of that really is kind of trial and error. I mean, I wish I could just give you, like, the magic sort of answer, but a lot of it really is trial and error. I mean, the first draft, you probably are going to go one of two ways. You're either going to include way too much material, which is what I tend to do, or it's going to be too skimpy. But let's say, since I know about the too much material better than the other, since, as I say, that's what I do, I mean, I sort of do throw the kitchen sink in to some extent
mm-hmm.
on my first draft. And then as I'm writing, I'm sort of figuring out the theme. And then in the second draft, then it's almost taking it paragraph by paragraph or scene by scene and sometimes sentence by sentence and say, okay, how does this paragraph enhance my theme? Does this reveal, you know, what it is this essay or this book focuses on? And if it doesn't, you just have to be ruthless and take it out and
mm-hmm.
kind of not love all of your paragraphs too much. You know, be willing to kind of sacrifice them. And also just tell yourself, well, okay, this paragraph doesn't work in this essay or book, but it'll be in my next one, you know, just to make yourself feel better. But it really is being, it's not something you necessarily are going to know on the first draft. I mean, I never do. But it is, you know, kind of as you revise the first time, revise. I mean, everything I write has, you know, pretty much a gazillion drafts. But so as you revise, it's just going through it, really, sentence by sentence. And maybe there's a whole kind of persona or character who you really wanted to write about, but maybe that, you know, person who is in your real life who you're trying to cast on the page, maybe that person really doesn't fit in that book. Maybe you have to take out, you know, one whole character or persona. I mean, sometimes that happens. Or there's a whole scene, you know, there's some episode that happened to you that you think is just absolutely fascinating and you want to try to shoehorn it in. But ultimately, by about the fifth draft, if it's feeling kind of clunky, then just be willing to say, okay, I've got to take this out, and, you know, hopefully that will appear something else. But a lot of that really is just trial and error, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. Oh, I really am enjoying hearing such a professional writer, you know, published writer with big publishing houses, et cetera, just to hear this information, because it's so interesting to hear when you are in the early stages of writing. And I'll just share something that I'd like to point out, and that's how you're talking about the drafts. And I think that a lot of times new or young writers, not necessarily young age, you know, 18, but young,
new to it,
think that you can just write and get it right the first time. And I read, and I'm sure you've read, Stephen King's book on writing. Mm-hmm. And at the back of his book, he has a really great example of how he, of his edits, like his first draft, and then
I remember that.
Do you remember that?
I
always stuck with me because it just made me realize, you know, oh my gosh, Stephen King does this, you know.
Oh yeah.
And so I think that it, you know, that that's really important to know, that you write it and you rewrite it and you rewrite it and you rewrite it. So that's
absolutely
one thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know any writer who just, you know, kind of cranks something out. I mean, everybody, it's a struggle. And even though you think, okay, I've written this book or this essay, now I sort of get it, everything you write is going to bring its own challenges. I mean, I spent 6 months on one like 16-page essay.
Oh,
I mean,
my gracious.
Yeah, and I mean, and I worked on that sucker every day, and it was, I just couldn't figure it out. I knew I had something to say,
right?
And I just, draft after draft after draft, I mean, it just took a long, long time, and a lot of struggle. And then once you even get down kind of the basic story, and, you know, you've got your plot, and you have your images, and you've got your metaphors, you have all of that, then, I mean, I still go through at least two or three drafts, just going sentence by sentence, just making each sentence as, you know, clear and precise as I can make it. I mean, you know, are the commas in place? I mean, that's, you know, you sort of go from the big thing from theme down to commas.
Right. Yeah, and I, you know, I think that that's something that's really important to point out, like while we're talking about this. Mm-hmm. Because there's just so many pieces to this whole writing memoir and getting published, et cetera.
Right.
But let's say, okay, you're to the point where you've had the courage, you've written, you've gotten your story down on paper, and then, and this is something Sue has been in our forum community at BoomerWomenSpeak.com a couple times, and most recently she was in there discussing her latest book, Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir, and I remember, I think this was a big topic, was finding the courage to show your story to friends and family in the world. So we go from saying, okay, I'm writing it, I'm hiding it, I'm doing the best I can.
Right.
And then you think, you know what, I really have a story that has healed me in the writing and that can probably heal other people. So now what am I going to do?
Sure. And there really are choices. And just so you know, I do have a whole chapter on marketing and publishing in Fearless Confessions. But I really would like to share a few of the websites here with your group. So,
okay, sure.
I mean, first of all, I mean, just so you know, I mean, there are three ways to get published. you know, you can get published with a small press, university press, you can find an agent and get published with a large New York City publisher, or you can self-publish. And I should also add that one of the members of Boomer Women is Lynn Tolson, who mm-hmm. I think is even with us today, and she wrote this great little article for my book, and I mean, she wrote especially for the book, so thank you, Lynn, again, about self-publishing and how she went about it and sort of the pros and cons of it. Now, if you're interested in a small press or a university press, which is my first book was published with the university press, a really good website that talks a lot about smaller presses is newpages.com, just what it sounds like, newpages.com. And that's just an amazing resource. Now, on the other hand, if you're interested in trying to find an agent, there's a really helpful book. It's called Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents. And I'm sure that's for sale on Amazon. But it's called Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents. But there are also like some free, you know, online websites. One is agentresearch.com. That's agentresearch.com, all, you know, one word. Another is, it's www.aar, and then put a hyphen in, aar-online.org, and that's the Association of Authors Representatives. So those are just a few places, you know, just to kind of get started. And, of course, once you start Googling, you know, agents and everything, there's just going to be all sorts of things to pop up.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else on that? Because I did want to kind of track back a little bit and ask you about showing the story to the friends and family. Like, can you give us an example of when you wrote your story and you know, you were ready to show it to someone? You know, who was one of the first people and what was their reaction? If they were a family member and didn't know what was going on in your home, or they did know what was going on but had never spoken about it, can you just tell us a reaction?
Sure. I tend to not be forthright with family.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, my parents were dead before I started writing my first memoir, so that, you know, frankly made it easier, I have to say. But I do have a sister, and frankly, I actually ended up telling her like 2 minutes before the book was going to be published, so I really put it off. But the first person I showed it to actually was both a friend, a writer friend of mine, mm-hmm. somebody who I knew from graduate school, and I trusted her. You know, I really, more than anything, actually wanted her to read it as, you know, kind of as literature. And did she think that it was literature, or was it just kind of something that was more kind of like a journal for myself to kind of figure things out?
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to sort of be fine either way. But she felt, you know, that I really should try to get it published. So her reaction, and from a personal standpoint, you know, she read it and she still liked me. She didn't think, oh, I was an awful person.
Yeah, that's what I think is important that you tell. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't, you know, she read all of these things that I'd gone on with my father in this incestuous relationship, and she absolutely did not judge me. I mean, just not at all. And, you know, as Dotsie mentioned, that book won a literary award, and I mean, to me, that's astounding, and I think that's really important for, you know, women to know. I mean, because when I sent it off to this contest, I was sort of sending it off sort of knowing that it would not win, but yet I would still sort of feel like I was trying to get published, because I thought to myself, well, gosh, you know, a memoir about a woman growing up in an incestuous family, you know, that's just not going to win a literary award. It just isn't. And then the judge chose it, and it did. And, I mean, that's empowering to me, but it's also empowering, I think, to all of us.
Right.
To women's stories in general. I mean, that this judge, you know, a well-respected author himself, you know, selected this book from all of the other manuscripts. So that was incredibly positive. And then he wrote me, like, just this really beautiful letter about, you know, what he thought of the book. And then the third person who read it was my editor at the University of Georgia Press, and he loved it. And so, you know, my immediate feedback was all just incredibly positive. And I think the kind of maybe the thing to take away from this is that, yes, there may be people in your family or friends who aren't going to like to hear the truth. I mean, that's true. That can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But again, and I said this before, but I think you can't sort of say this too many times, I still firmly believe that all of our stories will receive much, much more praise, and not like hollow praise, but I mean sincere praise, like, you know, like, thank you for telling this story, by your telling your story, you really helped me too, that kind of, you know, support,
mm-hmm.
empowerment. I just think that for me, at least in my experience, and really the experience of all, you know, my writer friends, it's been much more positive than not.
Okay, and you just have to believe that. You have to believe in your story, and
mm-hmm.
you have to believe in yourself.
Yes.
And that's a whole other piece of that courage.
Yeah, well, it really is.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to. Or if you don't believe in yourself, write anyway.
Good.
It's sort of like okay to do that, to sort of feel like really bad about yourself, but just still keep writing, because ultimately I think you will start feeling more positive about yourself and have more of a belief in yourself once you have 5 pages down on paper. I mean, once you have a sentence down, once you have 1 page, 10 pages, you know, 30 pages, you know, kind of with every word that you put down on the page, that kind of courage really sort of grows, like, oh, okay, I can do that. I wrote that sentence, and nobody else in the entire universe could have written that sentence. It's my sentence. I own it. This is a piece of me, and I put it down on paper. That's incredibly empowering.
It sure is. And you know what? Let's see. We're kind of running out of time, so I have a few things I want to squeeze in. Do you necessarily need an agent to market your story?
No, I mean, you only need an agent if you want to try a big New York publisher, you know, like Norton or Doubleday or Random
mm-hmm.
House. For the big ones, you do. But for a university press or the just hundreds and hundreds of smaller presses, and again, that the website for lists of all of those is that newpages.com, for those, you absolutely do not need an agent at all. And you just start collecting names. I mean, once you go to a website like New Pages, then, you know, sort of start going through them and look for, you know, publishers maybe who are interested in women's stories. I mean, they'll sort of tell you what kinds of things they publish. So once you come up with the list, then basically then you go to their website, and they'll give you submission guidelines. You know, maybe they want to see, you know, the first 50 pages. Maybe they just want a query letter. Whatever it is, you know, they'll tell you what their guidelines are. So, you know, but do your research. You know, don't send off your book unless you to a publisher that you're not familiar with, you know, what the kinds of things they publish, because then you're just sort of wasting your time and their time. So just, you know, browse the web. I mean, that's one of the great things. It's easier to get published now, or at least to find publishers, than it used to be, because it really is all out on the web.
And you can just submit right online, too. Yeah, and this might be a good time to talk about, like, the community of writers, because you talk about not submitting until you're
mm-hmm.
ready, and maybe that community, if you want to talk about the importance of
that,
because,
absolutely.
Yeah, that, I think, is probably a really good time to, you know, another time, actually, I should say, to use that community of writers.
Yeah, I mean, I think there really is. It really is important to be with other writers, because being a writer is very lonely and kind of thankless in many ways. And, I mean, I think there's sort of two ways to go about it. I mean, you can do it sort of formally. For example, I teach at the Slow Residency MFA in Writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts. And actually, if you're interested in that, it's www.vermontcollege.com. And it's a low residency, so basically you just go twice a year for 10 days, and then the rest of the semester you work one-on-one with your faculty advisor. Like, you know, this semester I have 5 students, and once a month they send me their work. But, you know, but just sort of being with that community at Vermont College is really, it's just amazing. I mean, I love the students, I love my colleagues, and it really kind of saves my life in many ways. But then there are other ways, you know, if you don't want to take on getting a whole MFA degree, you know, there are lots of summer writers' conferences. And if you go to a bookstore, or I think they have an online version, like Poets and Writers, it's all the bookstores have it. It's called Poets and Writers. And if you go through that, then you'll see ads for hundreds of writers' conferences in the summer. And, you know, just go to a writer's conference, you know, maybe 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, and you'll meet, you know, a lot of good writers there. If that's even too much, then, you know, just like go to your local bookstore and ask them if they know of any writers groups in town, or even readers groups. You know, just finding people who read a lot is really nice too. But either way, you know, I think that that's one way. Or, you know, on websites, I mean, like Boomer Women websites, you know, there's a strong presence there of writers and people who like to read and everything. So just, you know, so there are lots of different ways to find a community, and it's really just finding the one that suits you. I mean, I kind of like doing all of them, really. Just having, yeah, you kind of can't have too many writers in your life.
Right, and you know, oh, gosh, I lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, there's actually a woman in our forums who wanted a writer's group, and she launched her own. I mean, she just put something in her local newspaper, and she now has her own writer's group. But it's important, because you can get so holed up and so lonely and so zoned in on your own writing that you really need other people to read it and to give you feedback, and you have to have a tough skin, because like we were talking about, you know, it's not just writing, it's the rewriting and writing and rewriting.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, okay, let's see. We talked about some different publishing outlets, and I would like to share that I've done an interview with Sheree McConnell, who's the founder of the National Association of Women Writers, about different writing, like whether you have the personality for self-publishing or traditional publishing. A lot of it has to do with your personality, how much you're willing to let go, and how much you like to control your own project. And anyway, that teleseminar is on the members only page at nabbw.com, and Sheree did a really good job of explaining what route you might want to take based on your personality and your projects. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, like some people just aren't willing to give up a whole lot, and if that's your case, then you probably should go with self-publishing, because you have more control over the project.
Yeah, I mean, in a bottom line kind of way, and as I say, I do write about this more in Fearless Confessions, but I know that we're a little bit running out of time, but you know, the advantage of having somebody else publish your book is that they do all of the outside the writing, they do all the work. I mean, they do the marketing, they design it, they market it, and they get it into bookstores, and so you don't have to pay for any of that. But if you self-publish, then you basically do have to pay, you know, to actually get the book itself, you know, in a form, you know, between covers, and you have to do all of your own marketing. So that's, in addition to that sort of control thing, I think that's also just kind of something to keep in mind.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about tips for marketing the story.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are traditional ways, of course, which is, you know, sort of sitting around hoping to get reviews in the New York Times, but I don't always think that that's the way to go, because the New York Times reviews very few books, and they've not reviewed anything of mine, and that's just really tough. And as you probably know, more and more newspapers are going bankrupt anyway, and so as that whole market shrinks, you really have to be even more kind of proactive. And of course, with the advent of the internet, that makes it easier. I mean, because, you know, I went on a blog tour with this new book, and you know, basically just camped out a lot of different blog sites, websites where writers were hanging out, and besides just having a great time and meeting a lot of terrific people, you know, you also get to you know, market your book. The other thing that I've done is, since I have, like, these topics that I've written on, you know, recovering from incest or recovering from sex addiction, you know, I start contacting both local and national organizations that deal with things like that, and promoting myself as a professional speaker. Now, mind you, before I did this, I had never spoken professionally at all, but I just went ahead and decided, well, you know, heck, I can do this.
Exactly.
So I just said, yeah, I'm a professional speaker, and I can come speak to your group. And lo and behold, I wrote a speech, and I presented it, and it worked. So all of it's kind of a learning curve, you know, learning how to write, learning how to market your stuff. But I think that you do have to be a little bit kind of proactive, and just waiting for book reviews is not the way to go. But, you know, but then the web is just phenomenal. I mean, you know, with the hundreds and billions of websites out there, you know, it can take some time. But whatever your topic is that you're writing on, literally, whatever your topic, there's going to be some organization or some group of people on the Internet that will want to hear from you. And so whether it's writing a blog post or, you know, being interviewed, and then also finding out if they have a real organization that, you know, not virtual, but a real one where you can come and speak. I mean, it's all out there. And so just set aside, you know, if you have a book coming out, whether self-published or published with a publisher, set aside a few months, both before the book comes out, getting everything lined up, and then after the book comes out, just really, that's all you're going to do. I don't even think about writing when I'm promoting a book. There's just not enough time and not enough energy. So just be willing, you know, to kind of make that commitment.
Okay. Anything else about the publishing side that you want to mention? I mean, it's a huge topic, but
well,
any other little pointers?
Well, not really, but just to know that once your words are down on paper, you know, to just go for it. You know,
right.
You've taken that time to write, and I think, you know, why not try to publish it?
Right. So, and, you know, I will say this only because everyone's different, but I have a good friend who wrote a memoir about her childhood, and her husband read it, and it was just eating away at her to write this, and she ended up, after he read it, throwing it in the dumpster. I can't imagine it, but she did. She said she really only needed to write it for herself.
That's amazing.
Is that amazing? I still can't believe it. And I don't encourage anybody to do that, but I know her, and I know she did it.
Wow.
She was renovating her house, and there was a dumpster out front, and in it went. But anyway, I don't encourage people to do that, but it totally freaks me out. And when it comes to
memoir
writing, I just have to mention it. But, you know, there are a few things that there was in your book, Michelle Otero.
Yeah, Otero, right.
Otero, okay. She wrote a few things, and I believe these were her words, and I thought this would be interesting and important to share because I'm sure you remember this, but one of the things that she was talking about was telling the truth.
Right.
And she said, telling the truth, asking others to take responsibility for their actions or inaction is not the same as blaming. And I think that's important.
Right.
Okay? Because, you know, when you're writing about, you know, something, and, you know, we're talking about memoirs as being things that, you know, might not be, you know, something that, you know, is easy to tell. But there are memoirs that are wonderful to tell. So, you know, we have to mention that, too. But she also mentions, it lifts the heavy weight a survivor carries on her back and redistributes it among her family and her community. And I think that's huge.
It is.
It's like you carry this burden.
And then you ask other people to help you.
Yeah.
I think that article she wrote for the book is just beautiful. And you know, her story is that her brother had sexually molested her. And her, you know, the brother, I think to this day, is still really pretty angry at her for writing about it. But she does not regret. Yes, it was hard, you know, letting the family know and letting the family read it. I mean, she went through a really tough time with that. But ultimately, she feels so positive about having done that.
Yeah, she says, in writing memoirs and releasing family secrets, we're saving lives, which is what you mentioned in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, let's see. Any other resources, of course, other than your book and reading your memoirs? Because, honestly, I think we can learn so much from reading other memoirs, seeing their style, seeing how they start, seeing how they flashback, et cetera. I just think it's so important to read other ones. And I noticed while reading your book that you mentioned so many that you had read. So I know you're a big fan of memoirs.
Well, I am. And I should say that on my website, it's also in the book, but you can get this right instantaneously on my website. I have a reading list of contemporary creative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to my website is suewilliamsilverman.com. And if you scroll down on the home page on the right-hand side, you'll see a link that says Sue's reading list or something like that. Just click on that, and it'll take you to this really long reading list. And, you know, it's divided by category, which sort of helps you. And just kind of, you know, browse through there and look for books, look for different categories that might interest you. You know, some are about childhood, coming of age. Others are about illness. Others are about relationship. So, you know, just kind of scroll through that and start reading because, yes, absolutely. I when I was growing up, all I did was read. You know, I just can't say too much about the importance of reading to help you in your own writing.
Right. Okay, so let's see if anybody has any questions for Sue. And if you do, you have to push star six, so we can hear you. And sometimes it takes people a couple seconds to get the courage to ask a question.
But do feel free to ask questions because, you know, that's what we're here for.
Yes. Is someone there?
I'm here. This is Lynn Tolson.
Oh, hey, Lynn. Hello.
Sue gives me courage and Dotsy gives me courage.
And you give us courage.
That's right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Sue, for mentioning my essay in Fearless Confessions about publishing.
Yeah, it's a terrific essay, and I'll just tell you pretty much everything you want to know about self-publishing. Lynn did just a terrific job on that.
And I've also read Lynn's memoir. Lynn, do you want to tell us the title of yours and your web address?
Oh, sure. The title of my book is Beyond the Tears, A True Survivor Story, and the web address is beyondthetears.com. And I wanted to say that I had all the doubts that were mentioned in terms of writing a memoir and then putting it out there, and I probably kept my book a secret for about a year, and I had it in manuscript form. Now, Dotsy had asked, who do we share it
mm-hmm,
with?
Mm-hmm.
At first, I was sharing it with my therapist. I was going through therapy for my cancer experience, and it was a matter of a life review. So that's how my book about my childhood started. And she said, you know, you really should think about publishing this. So my point is I didn't see any other books like it. I said, I can't publish it. There's nothing else like it out there until I came across Because I Remembered Terror Father by Sue Silverman. And I just was blown away about what I was reading, the authenticity, the truth, and the style of writing. So I've said over and over that Sue has been my hero, not only in terms of the subject matter, but also in terms of the exceptional way that she crafts her writing.
Thank you so much. That is so sweet of you. I know, Lynn and I, we've known each other for ages now. Yeah, thank you so much. That really is sweet.
Yeah, and I recommend the program at Vermont College, even if somebody can't go for the residency. The conference is really, really worthwhile.
Yeah, we have just a summer conference also outside of the MFA program. I think it's in August, and there's information about that on that vermontcollege.edu website also. Oh, I might have said before the website was vermontcollege.com. It's vermontcollege.edu.
Okay, and we'll change that on the transcript,
okay,
too.
Great.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you so much, Lynn. And you know what's funny is that when Lynn mentioned she'd shown it to her therapist before, when you asked me who the first person I'd shown it to, I, like, blanked on the fact that it was my therapist was the first person. I sort of, like, in a way, he's just so close to me that I was thinking sort of more of outside people, you know, like
oh,
this
right.
writer friend that
right.
I had mentioned. But, of course, my therapist was the first person who saw it.
And he's the one that encouraged
person.
You, right?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Okay. All right,
right.
Good. Okay, anybody else have a question for Sue? About writing or publishing?
Or life.
Or life in general, right?
Hi, this is Suzanne calling from Phoenix, and I wasn't able to get on the call till the last, like 20 before the hour, and I'm just really looking forward to hearing the audio, right, that will be available to hear the rest.
Oh, good.
I'm really happy to meet you and hear what you're up to.
Thank you. So are you writing also?
I am writing. It's more strategies, but it's a lot about my mom. When your mom has Alzheimer's.
Oh, interesting.
Strategies to keep you sane.
Yeah.
Professional. Yeah.
Well, that is such an important topic. I mean, particularly, you know, for us like boomer women, you know, that our parents, you know, right now are just struggling with that a lot. And that's, you know, I think that's such an important thing for you to write about, to figure out for yourself. And it's something that just, you know, it's scary.
It is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been the last 3.5 years for me, and the journey and what I've learned all the way along the way, things that I never would have anticipated,
right,
have been really quite extreme.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like I've come to terms a lot with the whole situation, and I wish that I had had some support of this type as I was in the early stages of adjusting to this.
Mm-hmm.
That inspired me to write, and
good.
Look forward to hearing the rest of your interview.
Well, that's great. Yeah, but, I mean, I think that that really is an important story. So I hope that you do, you know, start writing it. I mean, Alzheimer's really, it's such a scary thing, and I think writing, it's not that necessarily the fear goes away as such, but yet by understanding it and understanding what it means to you, you know, it helps on some other level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let me just mention, this is really crazy. I've been journeying with you with this Alzheimer's thing, just not to get off topic, but my father-in-law has it, and he's been in a care facility now, I guess, for about, I don't know, a little more than a half a year. But I just read an incredible book that a colleague of mine told me about, because she knew that my father-in-law had Alzheimer's. And I've read lots of books about Alzheimer's, but I read one that is really incredible. It's called Still Alice, and it's a novel written by a woman. And it's about a woman who, I think it was, she taught at Harvard, and she got Alzheimer's early onset at age 51, and it's written from her perspective of what it's like to have Alzheimer's. And the story, really the gist of the story, is that even though they have Alzheimer's, they still have something to say, and it's like it's in them to say these things, even though it doesn't always come out the way they want it to. It's just so interesting, but I highly recommend it. It's called Still Alice. I read it within 24 hours, and I am really busy, so I stayed up late, and I got up early, and I read it. So, yeah, so check that out. Okay, so anybody else have a question? We have just a couple more minutes. Any questions about writing or getting published? Okay, maybe we've covered everything, Sue. So I just want to thank you so much. I mean, it is such a joy to interview someone who's accomplished so much in the writing world, and also as far as sharing your stories and giving other women the courage to share and heal themselves through your writing. So I just want to thank you again, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
As soon as we have this transcribed and we have the link to the audio, we'll share it with you so you can share it with your audience.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just really thanks to you and to your amazing organization and all the boomer women out there. But I also just like to thank, you know, people who called in, you know, just to sort of join this conversation. I really appreciate your listening and asking some questions. It's, you know, I've really enjoyed this a lot.
Well, so good. And, you know, a lot of people register for the call and they can't necessarily be on it. They just want to make sure that they get a link to it. So,
right,
you know, a lot of people listen at a later date.
Sure.
And then it's always archived on the members-only pages at nabbw.com. And so, you know, they just get listened to at random. That's for darn sure.
Sure.
So,
and also, again, I just like to invite you also all just to, you know, visit my website. It's SueWilliamSilverman.com. And there's a contact information there if you want to email me, too.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for being on the call. We appreciate it. And, Sue, have a great day.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
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 Bye.